I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. Detroit is in the news again, with Time Magazine launching a bureau of sorts from the city. But to get a real local perspective, we'll talk with Katie Locker and Dave Egner of the Hudson Weber Foundation. Hudson Weber provides grants to improve the quality of life of metropolitan Detroit. And Katie and Dave will tell us about the work they're doing to revitalize the very heart of the city. On the other side of the globe, Mumbai is a city with an exploding population and a housing crisis that is leaving 9 million people without a home. Prathima Manohar is the founder and editor-in-chief of the blog called The Urban Vision. It highlights the best practices from around the world and how they can be put to use in India's cities. All that plus the latest from Planetizen and our City Views commentator Walker Smith coming up after this news. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Since 1939, the Hudson Weber Foundation has provided grants and leadership to urban visionaries in the city of Detroit. The foundation's latest collaboration is called 15 by 15, and it's an effort to attract 15,000 young college-educated households to the heart of Detroit by the year 2015. Katie Locker is the program director at the foundation, and Dave Egner is its president and CEO. There is so much being written and talked about in the national press today on Detroit. Time Magazine has a group of reporters living there full-time. Tell me from your perspective, what is the state of Detroit today?
Wow. That's a tough question, Carol. It's a two-edged sword. Detroit is at a fork in the road. We have made lots of movement in the right direction in some areas, and we sit stagnant in others. I would say that there is a set of efforts that will redensify the city, reclaim a part of the city for what will be market-rate housing, vibrant, walkable neighborhoods. At the same time, we've got to think carefully about right-sizing the city. And as you know, that's fraught with political pitfalls, and we don't yet have the political will to make that decision. So it is an opportunistic time in Detroit, and a lot of great things can happen. But if we don't capitalize on this opportunity, on this point in history, we could sit stagnant for another two decades.
Katie, one of those efforts to densify the city in particular parts is the 15 by 15 initiative that you are part of. Tell me about that initiative.
15,000 by 2015 is our shorthand for an effort to attract and retain young talent in greater downtown Detroit. We set a goal for ourselves of 15,000 young talented Detroiters by 2015, and it comes from a lot of pieces of work we were doing and identifying related to our grant making and the strategy of our board. The first of those was some work done by Michigan Future, which is sort of a think tank here and research institute here in Michigan that looked at what identifies the economic strength of a city and of a region and a state. And the best predictor of that success, as you know, Carol, is the number of college-educated young people. Under 35 and college-educated is a great predictor of city success. When we looked at us in comparison to the city of Chicago, we have 15,000 young talent under 35. The city of Chicago has over 100,000 proportionally, and the same can be said about other regions. We are far behind. So we saw this as an opportunity to focus on young talent, focus on this one of the strong areas of our city that is attractive to young talent. And we're now focusing our grant making and focusing the coordination we do with our partners around a vision to bring that young talent to the city.
Katie, I'm so impressed, as you know, with the 15 by 15 initiative. We've talked about it many times. But I know, Dave, that could not have been easy to focus focus on something different and new and narrow, important as it may be, in your grant making at the Hudson Weber Foundation. How did you bring a board along to say, we're going to stop doing some things that we've been doing to refocus and narrow in some ways our efforts because this will have a greater impact?
Not as difficult as it might appear. the work of 1515 is concentrated on the same core funding missions that Hudson Weber had before there was a 1515. What we had to do, Carol, was re-educate the board, and being able to show statistics on where we were with young people, where we were on per capita earnings, certainly helped. We had to move the board carefully with us as partners as we talked about engaging in a more proactive way a series of key partners like the anchor institutions of Wayne State University, Detroit Medical Center, and Henry Ford Health Systems. It was not so much changing how we funded as how we engaged. So once the board saw on the ground the anchors working together and starting to merge their image, self-image of what should happen in the city with this vision of 15,000 by 2015, the board started to move with us. So it was more a process and a journey for them than it was a difficulty and an exercise for us.
Katie, let's come back and talk about the initiative itself and the strategies associated with the initiative, because you've set out a very specific goal, which I think is quite unusual for, frankly, for foundations, for any civic initiatives. You've set a goal and you've set a timetable by which you will achieve the goal. Very impressive. So what are the strategies you're beginning to employ beyond focusing on this corridor in Detroit?
I think the first strategy that we employed is the most global and the most important, and the one that Dave and I keep coming back to in our conversations, whether it's related to grant making or convening folks or really deciding anything we're going to do, and that is ensuring that we have a shared vision with all of our partners, and that shared vision is the 15,000 by 2015, and does ensure that all of our partners, whether they are a large anchor institution or whether they are a young professional that's starting a new retail shop on one of the streets of Detroit, that everyone is acting in their own self-interest. In the end, if all we have is a vision of 15,000 by 2015, then it's just a nice tagline and it doesn't get us anywhere. And so what we're trying to do, particularly in the role as grant makers, is to ensure that we're finding with each partner that's working in greater downtown Detroit the role that they can play within that vision. And it's different for everyone. So with anchor institutions, we're working very hard to identify within their business model what can they do to reinforce 15,000 by 2015.
Now, Katie, before you get much farther, I want you to tell me what an anchor institution is.
For us, there's a lot of levels of anchor institutions, and people can approach it in different ways. We're looking at the very large anchor institutions in our Midtown area that are EDS and MEDS. They are rooted into their place. Wayne State University is not going to pick up and move, and they have a substantial investment in their physical infrastructure and in the people. Any corporation, and we have certainly seen this in the last few years, as have many other communities, can potentially pick up and move from one headquarters locations to another. It's very hard for a hospital or a college to pick up and move. So they are anchors to the community, they reach out to the community, and it's of benefit to them to have a neighboring community that serves their institution that is attractive as their patrons, students, employees come in.
Let me just stick with this question a minute on how anchored institutions really are in communities. I mean, certainly some communities have experienced the event that a hospital will in fact pick up and move. In other words, if enough people move to out of town or to the edge of town, they may in fact follow their customers. I think about universities today, to the extent that they move courses online, they may not move, but they may not expand. How are you thinking about that for the future of not only your initiative, but for the city of Detroit in a larger way?
The three main anchors we're working with, we've gone about the process of talking about neighborhood and ensuring that their mission and their focus is clearly on building community around their neighborhood. Before we ever were engaged in this process, Henry Ford Health Systems was concerned about the entryways into its main campus. So here's the core founded main campus of a major medical facility. They're likely not to leave because they've invested millions upon millions of dollars in that campus and continue to invest there. By overlaying our strategy on what they were already doing on the entryways, on considering how vendors might be closer to that campus, we're able to stimulate and augment the anchor work as we call it, the anchor work that's underway there, the work of bringing back the neighborhood and bringing businesses in, et cetera. The caution is, if they're not committed to neighborhood to begin with, we're not going to turn them. And if they don't see this within their self-interest, they're not going to invest in neighborhood and community. So it seems to me there's two ways to get them engaged in that. Either by really showing them the business case of how you'll increase enrollment or hospital bed nights and attractiveness to the medical community, you'll bring in new young talent that want to live in urban centers, or by getting incriminating pictures of them that you can hold against them for the rest of their lives.
That doesn't sound like a good philanthropist, Dave.
No, that's why we chose to go with the former instead of the latter.
Okay, I want to let Katie come back and finish up her thought, because I interrupted it and it was important. Because you've talked about anchors, you've talked about their self-interest, acting in their self-interest. How does that then get the neighborhood more dense with more people living there and working there and doing, you know, fun things there?
Sure. There's two parts to that, and one of it is, what do we do with the anchors? And the other part is, who are the other partners we have to bring into this? Because the anchors alone will not change the neighborhood in a significant and comprehensive way. But on the anchor side, what we are doing with the assistance of folks who did this work in West Philadelphia around the University of Pennsylvania and have worked in other parts of the community is identifying with all three of these anchor institutions how they can increase their buying power, how they can increase the number of employees that they hire from Detroit, and how they can increase the number of people that work for them now who live in and around the institution. So how can they drive up the demand for this neighborhood and therefore allow us to have more retail, more housing, more of a walkable, attractive environment? So on the anchor side, we're working with them on all of these things that do not cost them extra money. They already buy from all kinds of providers of goods and services. They already hire and they have natural churn in their employment. And they already have some employees who would like to live closer to work and may want to live in Detroit but haven't figured out how to access it or don't have the amenities they need. So we're not asking them to do anything that costs them more. We're asking them to look differently. And we have been overwhelmed, absolutely overwhelmed, by the support of these anchor institutions to look differently and to work with the folks that can help them do that. But it can't be done alone, and that's where our strategy ensures that we continue to work with community partners, the community development organizations and economic development organizations that work in and around these neighborhoods. It's in their self-interest to build a neighborhood that continues to attract a new generation of Detroiters, and then to work with the folks who actually live in the neighborhood. And the folks who want to live in the neighborhood. We have incredible retailers and young residents and new residents who want to be here and who want to be part of the change. And how can we support them?
Katie, for those who don't know Detroit, describe the area of the city you're talking about.
Detroit is 139 square miles of land, and it can be overwhelming, not just to outsiders, but even to insiders. It's a lot of land. It's a lot of different neighborhoods, and there's different pockets of Detroit, just like in any city, many different neighborhoods. And what we've identified is it's too overwhelming for us, for just about anyone, to try to make a global change to 139 square miles. So we've looked at those neighborhoods that most represent the walkable, dense environment that young talent is looking for, and the strongest neighborhoods in many ways in our community right now, although we have some strong single-family home neighborhoods scattered throughout the city. This is the core of the city. It's the central business district and the neighboring areas where Wayne State University and the hospitals are located, where our Eastern Market, the largest open-air market, is located. It's an area that's probably about 2.5 square miles that we think has the greatest potential in the sort of medium term to look like the city that young talent is coming towards now.
Mm-hmm. I think it's such an interesting strategy. Dave, in addition to running Hudson Weber, you're also running a $100 million fund that's been put together by a group of philanthropists. What do you plan to do with that will make a difference to Detroit's future?
That's the New Economy Initiative, and it really is terrific when 10 funders can get on the same page and pool their resources in this manner. So we're grateful to those 10 foundations that have pulled together for this effort. We're looking specifically at trying to help accelerate the transition to a more innovative economy. So there are three buckets of activities we're undertaking. One is building out an entrepreneurial ecosystem. 100 years ago, if you wanted to create something or invent something, you came to Detroit. I mean, this was the Silicon Valley of the turn of the century. We didn't just have cars. We had stoves. This started out as a lumber town. There were tons of innovations that grew up. The entrepreneurial environment here 100 to 80 years ago was incredible. It's still in the DNA. So how do we create the ecosystem to make that what's become dormant gene after 70 years of success in the auto industry a dominant gene? So it continues to be an area that invents and creates and innovates and looks at high-tech solutions. There's great potential in that. We've got outstanding resources for it. Another bucket is looking at the current assets. How do we take advantage of the most crossed international border in North America that we share with Canada through Windsor? How do we take advantage of having a fifth of the world's fresh water supply outside our back door? Three research universities, tier one research universities that are within 75 miles of each other. So we're looking at how those play into that ecosystem. And finally, workforce. How do we do the best to create an educated, working workforce that has entrepreneurial spirit? That's everything from the issue of economic inclusion. How do we take those that are the most underrepresented and get them into the workforce? But also, how do we catch this tremendous talent of engineers and designers falling out of the auto industry and redeploy them in the economy? It's a wonderful opportunity, Carol, to try to, I think this is America's laboratory for working on economic development, and we're excited. How this interfaces back with 1515 is also exciting. Part of that entrepreneurial ecosystem is rooted right here in this Midtown area of Detroit, the greater downtown area where we're working on our pieces. So the work of Hudson Weber and New Economy Initiative are very entangled at this point when you look at creating a culture of change and a culture of entrepreneurial activity.
Dave, you talked earlier about the need to right-size the city, and I saw a recent announcement by your mayor, Mayor Dave Bing, that he was intending to do a better job of right-sizing government, basically shrinking government to better fit the number of people who now live in Detroit. I mean, it's political dynamite because everyone wants to right-size until you tell me I'm the one being right-sized. And, you know, and so if you're not going to pay attention to my neighborhood, I've been the last holdout in my neighborhood, I've done what I was supposed to do, and now you're going to abandon me. It's hard. Do you see a path way to that? Because I think so many cities are struggling with this. European cities have struggled with it. Do you see any promising pathway to this?
I think it is a series of tough choices, Carol. There is no direct pathway. You have to start with just the cold, hard reality that you can fit Boston, San Francisco, and the island of Manhattan inside of Detroit and have 20 square miles left over. And we have 900,000 people or less in the city. So how do you police that? How do you run infrastructure to that? There's no way to provide quality services over that kind of landmass with only a taxpaying body of less than 900,000 people. So that's a cold, hard reality. Then you have to take a look at how do you master plan that? Is it just a master plan? There are going to be neighborhoods that have to be turned into other uses than residential. This is tough stuff, and Mayor Bing, I think, is up to this task in time. In the meantime, he has a $300 million budget deficit to fill, and he has to deal with right-sizing the existing employee base to fit the budget, not just the issue of the land. So this land use issue is overwhelming, but again, I think this is the laboratory. I think Detroit should gather all of the greatest thinking we can from around the world. We've talked to the Brookings Institute and others about what they're doing, and eventually we'll be able to get in place a strategy to deal with this. But I think it's down the road many, many months.
What has been the toughest part of getting a big initiative with very clear, specific goals that people will know you did it or you didn't, like 1515 underway and then seeded into the community?
Well, one thing that Katie and I have learned, and I think we learned it in other places and collectively brought it to Hudson Weber, this is not Hudson Weber strategy. It can be something that we help to inspire, but we've got to give it away. And that's a concept that's foreign, especially in the Rust Belt. You know, we're set to compete. The greatest sports cities in the world are in the Rust Belt because we know how to compete better than anybody else, with ourselves or with others. So we're not looking for credit. We're looking to give away anything we develop to try to find a way to inspire others to act. I think that's the first rule. The second is the self-interest issue again. We need to let folks that we must have involved in the process understand that they're not giving up anything. They're gaining through this kind of process. And that's tougher than it may appear because it requires a change on their part. And you can put the carrot out in front. You can show them how they'll have a better business model, but you have to show them over and over again and be patient in that process. And then third, the thing that I think we've struggled the most with is even after those first two, there are ongoing turf battles. And that's going to continue to happen because along the way with these initiatives, there'll be some people that feel like they're not engaged enough or not leading enough. We're being very cautious with that and trying to maneuver in sensible and sensitive ways around those issues.
At this point, what do you think is the greatest challenge, the biggest stumbling block to Detroit's future?
I would give you two. First is one of perception. Having time here, buying a house, looking at Time Warner, putting all of their magazines on the issue of Detroit is a tremendous opportunity. It has many people in this town scared to death that they've come here to document the demise of a city. But we see it as a great opportunity for them to see a rebirth of a city, and that's what we want to present. This perception issue is overwhelming to us. The second issue feeds into that. It's more of a, that's more of the macro. The micro issue is safety and perception of safety. When you look at even the neighborhood we're working in, there's not enough lighting. There's not enough police presence. People have to feel safe. The crime rate on the campus of Wayne State University is lower than almost any university in America. You wouldn't know that if you looked at Detroit and said it can't be. It's in the heart of the city. But it's more safe there than it is on virtually any other campus in any city in America. But there's a perception of crime because the lights aren't on. 80% of the light grid is out around Wayne State University on any given night. There's not enough feet on the street in the police force. Wayne State is up the ante on that. Their police force is out in greater force now in greater number and concentrating on greater traffic areas, and we're starting to see a difference. But unless we turn that perception issue around, both the crime perception and our perception as a second-class or third-class city, we'll continue to struggle with all these issues.
I have one more question for you, Dave. I know that you've had your mayoral ups and downs, shall we say. There have been times recently when, for whatever reason, there was a feeling that the mayor could not be a productive part of the work to move the city forward. But I'm wondering, from your standpoint as a leading philanthropist in the city, as someone with a goal and a feeling of urgency about getting things moving, what do you do when you don't have a cooperative partner in the mayor's office?
You keep fighting every day. You keep doing what's right in the city. And I think, Carol, we're at a very interesting point in history where there is a void in leadership. And I'm not talking Detroit specific. I'm talking about nationally. The way the budgets are working out in what's been a down economy, outdated tax codes in virtually every municipality in every state, government does not have the funds to do what it used to do. And you don't have government leaders, elected officials, standing up for the most part saying we have to change, we have to tax differently, we have to think differently. I think that void is starting to be filled. I'm happy to say in Detroit, we have an open city council. I'm not happy to say that. But what I'm happy to say is those running for that open city council in this election, there's a vast majority of those that are young, energetic, and want to change the city. I think that's a great testimony to what could be in the city. Katie, about half the candidates are in their 30s.
Mm-hmm.
It's really exciting to see that. So I think you keep pushing, and you keep pushing on the right issues. And I will say that I think that the ups and downs in the mayor's office helped to drive this group of young people into running for office. They were unhappy, and they said, you know, we're going to do something about it. So I have great hope that the public sector is going to step up in a way it hasn't stepped up in Detroit in a couple of decades.
Katie Locker, Dave Eggener, I appreciate so much what you're doing for the city of Detroit and using that as a laboratory to show us all the way. Thanks so much for being our guest on Smart City.
Been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Katie Locker is program director and Dave Eggener is president and CEO of the Hudson Weber Foundation in Detroit. Coming up after the break, we'll speak with Prathima Manohar of the website The Urban Vision. She'll give us an insider's view of the housing crisis in Mumbai and the public-private partnerships that are forming to solve it. You're listening to Smart City. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. For the latest in the world of urban planning and design, we turn to Nate Berg of Plan Edison.
When it comes to a problem like homelessness, there are two ways to go. You can throw money at it, or you can invest. The difference may seem semantic, but according to a new report, choosing one over the other could not only help the problem, but also save millions. The United Way of Greater Los Angeles has just released the results of a 4-year study that shows developing permanent housing for the area's homeless population would be dramatically more affordable than allowing them to stay on the streets. By building permanent housing for homeless people, they become less reliant on expensive public services, according to the report. A recent article in the Los Angeles Times says that housing the county's roughly 73,000 homeless people would save taxpayers about $20,000 a year per homeless person in expenses on public services. That's an annual savings of about $1.4 billion. Meanwhile, western cities east of California are feeling a bit left out. They are nowhere to be seen on the map of federally prioritized high-speed rail corridors, and officials in these cities want in. So they're taking the initiative and forming their own coalition, the Western High-Speed Rail Alliance. With representatives from Phoenix, Las Vegas, Reno, Denver, and Salt Lake City, the group is looking to lay out plans for a series of intercity high-speed rail projects, despite the federal government's cold shoulder. According to an article in the Arizona Republic, the group is hoping to ride the momentum of their city's recent explosive growth to prove their regional worth. And though California may be at the top of the government's list of high-speed rail projects, the rest of the West is hoping it too can get a piece of the action. And finally, in Brazil, nationwide celebrations followed the recent announcement that Rio de Janeiro was selected as the host of the 2016 Summer Olympics. Now that the party's over, the work has to begin. According to a recent article from USA Today, 15 new sporting venues will need to be constructed for the event, as will extensive transportation infrastructure. Transportation officials are planning to add 8 additional miles to the city's subway system and develop a raft of new bus lines to connect the city's neighborhoods to the 4 separate Olympic zones. Overall, the city is expecting to invest $14.4 billion to host the 2-week event, which government officials say will create more than 100,000 jobs per year over the next decade. The city is hoping to parlay its Olympic investments with other projects related to the city's hosting duties when the 2014 Soccer World Cup comes to Brazil. But for many in the poverty-stricken country, this investment in temporary sporting events just looks like a drain on funds that could go towards fighting Brazil's more permanent problems. For Planetizen, I'm Nate Berg.
Nate Berg is the assistant editor of PlanEdison.com. My next guest is Prathima Manohar. She's the founder and editor-in-chief of the fascinating blog The Urban Vision that takes an international view on city building and highlights the best practices of sustainable and economically vibrant cities. She joined us in our office to talk about her perspective on India's cities. I ask her what inspired her to create The Urban Vision.
India is perhaps one of the last large rural economies of the world. We are only about 30% urban at this point in time. Our country has a great, grand opportunity to leapfrog into a new model of sustainable urban development, socially inclusive as well as environmentally friendly. And the urban vision was really instituted to offer leaders in our country within the public sector, the private sector, to look at the best practices in approaching urbanization, to learn from the failures as well as successes from other parts of the world. So it was instituted to inspire good urban development thinking.
What are the big leaps you have to make?
Even the 30% sounds like a small number. In absolute numbers, it's larger than the population of the United States. We still have a lot of challenges in dealing with transforming existing cities to be more sustainable. You know, moving towards models of mass transit, moving towards creating homes for everybody who lives in our cities. And yes, and then capacity building. How are we going to fund? How are we going to have people who are going to build the next generation of cities in India? So those are the two big challenges, moving existing cities into sustainability as well as creating new cities that are sustainable.
I had an opportunity a few years ago to visit Mumbai and Bangalore. Mumbai is wonderfully vibrant, but of course plagued with slums. The air in Bangalore reminded me of the air in Beijing, very hard to breathe. So those are two obvious challenges India's cities face. What are the other major urban challenges?
Just to give you a sense of affordable housing challenge in India, the city of Mumbai, which is the financial capital of our country, has a housing shortage of 50%. I mean, the city has 50% of its people living in slums. In absolute numbers, that's 9 million people. The financial aspect, the design aspect of solving a crisis of that nature is huge. It's perhaps one of the most challenging urban contexts in the world. And to ensure that we move them to formal housing in a sustainable, socially inclusive manner is a huge challenge.
So where do you start?
I think there needs to be a plan. How do you address the challenge of this size? I think India has always idealized about village life. I think we need to move towards accepting cities. And we recognize that cities are perhaps at the heart of the challenges of the current era, whether it is social equity, whether it is climate change. I think it's important for India to recognize that cities are perhaps at the heart of the solutions to a lot of the problems that we are seeing today. That's a big challenge that I face personally, getting policymakers, the leaders within India, to embrace urbanization, because that's the first step. When we are still a majority rural nation, the urban agenda gets not enough focus or no focus, because we are not the majority of the country. And that's the first step, that we embrace urbanization and clearly have some kind of a macro strategy framework to address it. I mean, I recognize the fact that if you don't adopt the right model of urbanization, there's going to be huge challenges in terms of food security, energy security, even the large social geography of our country. So we can go either way at this point. We can go towards, you know, being a society that the world will look up to, or we can drown in chaos. And drown the world in chaos as well, Carol.
We have a similar problem in the U.S. of idealizing village life, small towns and suburbs. How are you getting the attention of policymakers on this issue?
In the early part of what the Urban Vision is doing, it is trying to create a dialogue about urban issues. We're doing this through communication channels. We are currently producing a video interview series featuring some of the world's leaders who've managed to transform their cities. So policymakers get inspired to think about cities in a different manner. A lot of media engagement to get media to talk about these issues, which will then get the larger, you know, public involved about these issues. Ground level forums. Clearly, one side is communicating these issues. And second is India recognizes the challenges of its cities and participating in that dialogue. I mean, anybody who lives in our cities talks about the challenges that are cities, and using those platforms to project the idea of ideal urban development models, and really also focusing on the fact and highlighting that cities can be the solution to get policymakers to recognize that it is inevitable, that we need to embrace it. And those are the challenges that we face every day to get Indian government leadership to acknowledge and embrace urbanization.
Which leaders have you identified that have transformed their cities that you believe are particularly inspirational?
The context of cities is clearly challenging all across the globe, but there have been few leaders that the world looks at as inspiration. A lot of the South American leaders. Enrique Peñaloza is a hero to me, and I'm sure to every other urban leader in the world. We are also looking at people who are trying to create new models of urban development, whether it is the creators of Dong Tang, New Songdo City, because we need both of that. We are going to build cities from a scratch. We will need to reorient existing cities. So we're looking at people who are, you know, who have new ideas about city building. Also, we are talking to people who are reorienting existing cities. There's also a lot of value within India itself, which we are trying to learn from. There are smaller best practices. You know, there's so much to learn from every city. I am in Chicago right now, and I see the value in which the city seems to deal with density and makes it humane. A lot of the Southeast Asian cities with high density are not able to make cities with such high densities very humane. Chicago has done a fantastic job of it, and I think new cities in India should learn from that. You know, there are parks in the city. You know, you're walking in a street with 30, 40-story buildings, which still has such a great, pleasant urban environment. A lot of the new generation cities in Southeast Asia have missed that. And I think we need to learn from cities like that.
Is progress being made?
In India?
Yeah.
There are sparks of ideas that have worked. It's a huge challenge, but in some ways, yes, there's still a long road to walk. But there are, you know, some sparks of brilliance.
Only a few years ago, India was treated as a major economic threat to the U.S. The trend toward outsourcing and Tom Friedman's book, The World is Flat, made India a constant source of conversation. Now we don't hear so much about India. Has there been some change, or is that just the fickleness of our media?
I don't think anything has changed fundamentally. India and China, considering that every sixth person in the planet will be a large part of the world economy, they will be a part of any new, you know, model of economy. They contribute to it. We recognize the fact that today we live in a globally connected world. Something that happens in the U.S. impacts India or China. The recent economic crisis is a good example of that. And I would not really look at the media as an indicator of what's happening. Or I guess at that point in time, it was a hype as well, to an extent. India is clearly one of the emerging economies. We still have a long way to go. Like I said, in many ways, if we don't deal with the challenge of urbanization, that economic success is not going to come to us. So in many ways, both of these debates are linked to each other. If India is not going to create cities that's going to attract global talent, our place as the leader of the world economy in the 21st century is not going to happen.
Are you seeing a trend in India toward expats returning?
Yes, there is this trend of what we like to call as brain gain. A lot of young people who actually went to US or other parts of the world and studied in the most, the biggest universities are actually coming back, setting up their businesses in India, working in India. India today is perhaps full of opportunities as well as full of challenges. I guess places with large challenges are also often places with big opportunities, and that's how it is. If people are willing to tread down the path of a challenging life, they are returning to India, but it's not an easy life to take on. A lot of my friends who lived here previously have moved back to India, but it's It's happening a bit.
What makes it tough for them to live there?
Just everyday life, Carol. It's tough to live in our cities. Just to get through a day is a challenge, to go to work, you know, in chaotic traffic jams. Most times, good quality mass transit is not available. It's a country in constant state of change. So those are the challenges that most people will find about India. And also, it's not defined and structured in many ways. You know, you need to work in this big box where a lot of things are not defined. I think that's what people who live in the U.S. and come back to developing world will find challenging, but also exciting if you look at it in the other way.
Why do expats see opportunity today that they didn't see, say, 15 years ago?
In 1991, people talk about this very often. India went through a change in terms of its economic policy. It opened to the world. That has changed the geography of opportunities in India a great deal. Today, if you can create products that are successful in India, you probably could be the next big global economic superpower as a company. It's constantly evolving. We've not reached, you know, there's still a lot to be done to retain that position, but there's great opportunity. There's our growth, you know, GDP rate is 8 to 9%. We are talking about it reaching 6% in an economic slowdown. So that's the level of opportunity when we're talking about the Western world, which is what, close to 1%. So that's the, you know, huge opportunity that exists. So whoever comes in today has a grand opportunity to be the next market leader.
Start with a 50% shortage of housing. You have to find ways to speed everything up. It's not as if the city growth is going to stop and let you catch up. It's a real dilemma. So how do you accelerate change and moving ahead?
When I spoke about the challenges of Mumbai, that's a very, you know, specific case. And if India doesn't learn from the failures of Mumbai, we are going to be in massive problems in the next couple of decades. The context of Mumbai itself was that of government trying to halt development. You know, there's a crazy supply-demand situation in the Mumbai housing market. Indian cities did not allow density to happen, which meant that the market could not create homes enough for the demand that existed. I think Indian cities need to recognize that as the first. Mumbai is a great challenge. We, like I'd mentioned to you, we are currently one of the shortlisted consortium to work that's been, you know, shortlisted by the government to work on the next Mumbai master plan. And how do you solve a crisis of giving homes to 9 million people? It's huge. We clearly need to look at new models of public-private partnerships, allowing private entrepreneurs to solve the public housing crisis. And we will need to look at new, you know, tools for that to happen. And I think a great urban design challenge is for this is going to be mass production of homes. How do you make that humane? That's going to be the challenge. There's a host of other areas that we will need to focus on. How are we going to fund this process? How are you going to make it sustainable? But we've not started to do that, Carol, yet. Mm-hmm. We are starting to talk about it, but there's a lot more that needs to be done. There are some new ideas that probably India has, the city of Mumbai has, where speculative housing today is funding affordable housing and moving slum dwellers into formal homes, which is a new model. I've not heard about it in any other parts of the world. Basically, a large slum community is taken over by a real estate developer, and he gives free homes to these slum dwellers. And he builds, you know, a nice piece of real estate there, which he sells to the city, and that kind of cross-subsidizes itself. And those are one of the models, but we will need to look at a whole new set of models to address the housing crisis. And clearly, for many, many years to come, the city is going to witness more people coming in. So we will need to build for them as well and solve the current crisis, housing crisis, which is for 9 million people. It is going to be the largest urban agglomerations in the world and by 2025. It's going to be a city of 26 million, which means that we are going to add 8 million more people, all of whom we need to create homes for. So it's a huge challenge, and I think it requires the best thinkers from all across the globe to add to ideas of solving it. Because in many ways, if India and China doesn't solve the problems of social equity as well as the environmental challenges of today, then the future of the world is going to be affected. In many ways, the environmental, social, and economic future of the world is going to depend on the manner in which we will deal with urbanization and the manner in which China will deal with urbanization. So it's a stake for the world, really, at this point in time, if we need to solve this crisis and look at innovative ways of solving it.
Prathima Manohar is the founder and editor-in-chief of The Urban Vision. We have a link to her site on ours, smartcityradio.com. Finally this week, our City Views commentator Walker Smith reflects on scarcity and how sharing what is rare brings us all closer together.
There is a picture online at sciencephoto.com called Global Water and Air Volume. It shows a 3D picture of the Earth, and next to it, two spheres that show the total volume of water and air. The sphere for air is slightly bigger than that for water, but the radius of each sphere is approximately the width of Western Europe. Indeed, when you look at this picture at sciencephoto.com, you cannot help but be struck by how precious these vital resources are relative to the total size of the Earth. Visually, there seems to be so very little of each. And it's even scarcer than it looks, for the spheres for water and air include water that is not drinkable and air that is not breathable. What sustains life on Earth is so dear, indeed, as the sciencephoto.com picture makes clear, a rare treasure. We don't often get a sense of this because we are caught up in our individual situations without much perspective on the whole. But we need reminders of our connections with the whole and what that means in terms of our responsibility to others. I am thinking of this in ways that are different than the environment per se. For example, did you know that your risk of causing an automobile accident goes up 23-fold if you text while you drive? The Virginia Tech Transportation Institute installed video cameras in trucks for an 18-month period to observe driving behaviors and likelihood of risk. Texting while driving makes drivers 23 times more likely to be involved in an accident. Of course, maybe this example is something that we all agree on, which is reflected in the growing political support for state laws banning texting while driving. But the Virginia Tech study also showed that merely reaching for a cell phone increased the odds of a crash by 7-fold, and dialing a cell phone increased the odds by 6-fold. Research suppressed for years by the National Highway Safety Transportation Administration found that the odds of an accident while talking on a cell phone are increased by 4-fold. This is equivalent to the odds of driving with a blood alcohol level of 0.08, which either is or is close to the legal limit in most states. Now, I don't mean to go on and on about texting and cell phone usage while driving. I only mean to say that our impact on others and thus our obligations to others are deeper and more extensive than we typically realize, even in our ordinary everyday lives. 2 years ago, who would have thought that the subprime loans being offered to underqualified buyers would deeply affect the welfare of everyone across the entire world? Could we have imagined a couple of decades ago that the U.S. would be dependent upon China to buy our debt, or that in Los Angeles you could detect measurable levels of air pollution from China? And of course, no one would have had any clue, even 10 years ago, that an electronic communications network, i.e. the Internet, would have brought the world together, both for better and for worse. We don't just live on a small planet, a tiny island of life in the midst of a vast universe. We live on a small planet that is completely connected in everything we do and every decision we make. It is a world beyond ourselves, to which we owe obligations and responsibilities to everyone else. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of the Yankelevich Monitor, a trend service of the Futures Company. He comes to us each week from Georgia Public Broadcasting in Atlanta. That's it for this week's show, but there's more Smart City Online. Head to our website, smartcityradio.com, to check out our archive shows, read my blog, and subscribe to our weekly newsletter. You can also let us know how we're doing by emailing us questions at smartcityradio.com or click on the contact button. Smart City's web content and audio archive are supported by CEOs for Cities. I'm Carol Coletta.